The town may be kind of small, but these folks have big smiles and big hearts. And they know what it is to have simple fun down our way, where old-fashioned singing and homey gatherings make living mighty pleasant.
He's our granddaddy, and that's Harry Smith. Harry Smith, in the early 1950s, put together a multi-volume set of vinyl for Smithsonian, consisting of early 78s, folk music, blues, things like that. He started a music revolution by simply putting together music that he loved, that he didn't want to be forgotten, music that had been abandoned.
Yeah.
He was our granddaddy in that sense of thinking that this music should not be forgotten. This music should be overlooked. This needs to be preserved. Harry Smith was doing landmark preservation. You're doing landmark preservation in your own way.
Dave's rolling.
Welcome to Abandoned Albums, the documentary podcast where we take a closer look at some albums that may have been forgotten about over time, and some albums you might not even know existed. I'm your host, Keith R. Higgins, and joining me from the mean streets of Staten Island, Rob Janicki. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Keith. How are you?
I'm good, Rob. I'm good.
But if you'll excuse me now.
Oh? Why?
Why, I'd like to go up to my room for a moment.
To call up that girlfriend of yours again? Sit down.
On this episode of Abandoned Albums, outsider music godfather and landmark preservationist Erwin Chusid stopped by Thunderlove Studios to talk with Rob and I about outsider music. You know, if there is an Abandoned Albums Obi-Wan Kenobi-like character, it's Erwin. This is an amazing conversation with an amazing man whose accomplishments are truly amazing. This is part one of a two-part episode, so here's the first part of our conversation with Erwin Chusid. Thank you for joining us, Erwin.
Welcome.
How did you find your way to what you're doing now?
It's an excellent question, and one that I've had to contemplate many times, because how the hell did I arrive at where I am now, considering where I was, let's say, 35 years ago? You're asking me basically how I found my career path.
I'm looking for career counseling.
Right. And there's an assumption there that, let's say, as a good starting point, my wiki page kind of lays out this biography that is in some ways inexplicable. There's no discernible pattern. There's nothing there that indicates, oh, this guy went to college and got a degree and then he went off and did this. Nothing like that. And the fact that it's difficult for me to describe what I do, when people say, what do you do? It's never a simple answer, although I have encapsulated it, which I'll explain in a second. This is a roundabout way of answering your question. Let's just say it wasn't planned. Over the past 30 years, I will concede I've had some success and some considerable accomplishments. I wasn't following in the footsteps of anyone. I did not have any kind of outline of how my life and career would play out. I kind of took it project by project, day by day, step by step, paycheck by paycheck, idea by idea, lead by lead, and it unfolded. There were turning points. When people say, what do I do for a living? I tell them I'm a landmark preservationist. And then they scratch their head and go, what does that mean? And then I further complicate matters by saying, I find things on the scrap heap of history that I know don't belong there, and I salvage them. And they say, yeah. And then I start throwing some names out with no assumption that they're going to recognize any of them. Because what I do is kind of focus on the margins. I never focus on the mainstream. I only have a vague awareness of what's going on in the mainstream, and I don't really care. It doesn't interest me. I'm always looking to discover and explore. And when I find something, I'm inclined to share, regardless of whether I think it's going to make me money or add to my career. This is just me being curious, stumbling upon something and thinking, wow, that's interesting. Huh, Do people know about this? Oh, they don't. Well, let me tell them about it. For the first 40 years of my life, I didn't have a career. I didn't have money. I didn't have a direction. But what I did have was curiosity. I had passions. I had interests. I had energy. I had a sense of humor. I was developing certain skills.
I can tell you I don't have money, but what I do have are a very particular set of skills. Skills I've acquired over a very long career. Skills that make me a nightmare for people like you.
I was learning about music. I was learning about film. I was learning about records. I was learning about cartoons. I was learning about how to write. I knew how to write. I got better and better at writing. I knew how to make people laugh. I knew how to be sociable. I was good at math. Every one of these things is important. Every one of these things was a building block. So I was organized. I knew how to organize things so I could find them when I'm looking for them. I had computer skills. I was on radio, still am. So as part of the mass media, I had been published. I had a logical mind, had a good work ethic, but also had a good, I think, a moral compass that I knew that whatever I would end up doing for a living, I had to do it honestly, with integrity, and that I was, as I was sort of heading into the music business, I began realizing that it is fraught with peril. It is populated by a lot of dishonest people mm-hmm. and a lot of honest people.
Sure.
And that I knew which category I wanted to be in. So I had all these building blocks. And I knew at some point that I didn't want to be broke. I wanted to have a career. I wanted to have work. I got tired of waking up in the morning depressed because I didn't know what I was going to fill my day with because I really didn't have enough. I didn't have a profession. I didn't have a job. I didn't have jobs. I didn't have a reliable source of income. And I didn't know who the hell I was or what I was doing or where I was headed. I only knew that there were certain things that appealed to me. So that sent me in these various directions throughout the 1980s, in particular, writing liner notes for Rhino Records, becoming an authority on what was called incorrect music, outsider music, music on the margins. And in particular, the biggest turning point in my life was being introduced to the music of Raymond Scott. There was a guy, a friend of mine, named Byron Werner. Byron, without realizing what he was doing, helped me find my path to professionalism and doing what I'm doing. Byron is an artist. He's a visual artist. He's a painter, also a record collector. He's very nerdy, and he knows it. That's a badge of honor.
Something we all share. We all share that nerdy music quality.
Back in the 1970s, Byron was collecting records that nobody else wanted. They were these easy listening, pop instrumental, exotica, these bland mid-century slabs of vinyl that were popular among stereophiles back in the 50s and 60s. Good for music for cocktail parties, dinner parties, background. It's music that no one in their right mind took seriously at the time. By the 70s, if you went looking for these records, you'd go in a record store, a used record store, and they wouldn't be in a bin, they'd be under the bin, you know, for a dime or 25 cents. Byron was collecting these records and loving them and considering them works of genius. And he was on a campaign to convince people that these records have merit, they are fascinating to listen to, and that the people who made these records were serious artists who needed to be recognized for their achievements. And he coined the phrase space age bachelor pad music. So Byron in the 1970s is playing these records to friends. One of his friends was a guy named Matt Groening. They were buddies from, I think, high school. And he introduced Matt to this music. And he told me later that Matt thought it was just garbage. You know, who cared about this music? And Byron said, you just wait. And a few years later, Matt admitted to Byron that he finally understood this music and he thought it was incredible. Matt, of course, later went on to do The Simpsons. And I think, I don't know the theme song of The Simpsons, but I was told that it was influenced by space age bachelor pad music. So Byron is on this evangelical mission to introduce his music to people.
Weather today in the greater Cincinnati area.
And love you so badly, I could...
They're solid plastic, so don't settle for imitation.
But the senator, while insisting he was not intoxicated, could not explain his nudity.
Baby, if you've ever wondered whatever became of me, I'm living on the air in Cincinnati.
I've been on radio station WFMU, freeform station, since 1975. I'm still on, doing a weekly show. Byron came down to WFMU in the mid-80s, and he brought these cassettes and slabs of vinyl of this music. And he was a guest on someone else's show. And I can distinctly remember being down there at the time and hearing this music and just thinking, he's right. This stuff is really interesting. So people at FMU started playing it. And then at some point, Byron was mailing me cassettes. I was living in Montclair, New Jersey at the time. But at some point, Byron's mailing me cassettes of this stuff because I just loved it. And I would make a note of which tracks I really liked and say, could you give me more of this person, more of this person? And two artists really stood out. One was Raymond Scott and one was Esquivel. Raymond Scott really... something about it. It almost didn't fit in the space age bachelor pad genre because they seemed older. These were, I think, were 78s, which was not really part of the genre that he was evangelical about. So he sends me a cassette of all these Raymond Scott 78s, and he says, you may recognize this music from Warner Brothers cartoons. I did. Of course I did. I thought, wow, this is really incredible music. And I got really curious about Raymond Scott, but this is pre-internet. Couldn't find out much information. By coincidence, at the same time, another friend of mine who did not know Byron, a guy by the name of Barence Whitfield, whose name is Barry White. He's a an R&B guy. He's in Massachusetts now, but you know Barence?
Not the Barry White.
No. Barry White was his real name, but he became Barence Whitfield because when he became a singer, he couldn't simply call himself Barry White.
Okay.
He became Barence Whitfield. He's an R&B belter. Barence Whitfield and the Savages is the band he most commonly records. He recorded for Rounder and Bloodshot and a bunch of other labels. He's great. And he's a really cool guy. He's a longtime friend of mine. He was out in Kansas City going through on tour with the Clarence Whitfield and the Savages, and he found a bunch of Raymond Scott 78s in a record store, and he really liked them, and he transferred his collection for me, and he sends me a cassette. So I've got two cassettes of Raymond Scott 78s with a lot of overlap, but a lot of stuff that didn't overlap. I combined it into one cassette, and I thought, wow, what a legacy this guy had, Raymond Scott. Who the hell is he? Where is he? Is he alive? Is he still recording? I started looking for his records. I couldn't find any. I started looking through music history books. He wasn't in them. I looked through jazz history books, and he was a footnote. The footnote was, oh, Raymond Scott had a band, and he recorded something called When Cootie Left the Duke, about Cootie Williams leaving the Duke Ellington Orchestra. That was it. His music was supposedly in Warner Brothers cartoons. I recognized the melodies, but he was never credited on screen. And there really weren't any Warner Brothers cartoon books at the time. So the available resources for research were limited. I'd go to the library and look through music history books, and there just wasn't much about Raymond Scott. And I thought, okay, this guy needs to be heard. He needs to be remembered. Again, I'm still broke. I still don't have a career, but I've had this passion, and I wanted to tell people about Raymond Scott. I started playing it on the radio. It's a non-commercial station, but it was not a career thing for me. It was just music I found. And every time I played Powerhouse, the phones lit up. Yeah, that was when people used to call radio stations and express their approval or their displeasure. So every time I played Powerhouse, the phones lit up. What is that? I recognize that. And I said, well, it's from Warner Brothers cartoons, and it's Raymond Scott. I still didn't know, where did Raymond Scott fit in with Warner Brothers cartoons? And I started thinking, this stuff's got to get reissued. It's on 78s, but who owns it? Well, at the time, I found out they were mostly on Columbia or Brunswick or Master Records, all from the late 30s, and that they were owned by Columbia at the time. This is the late 80s. I talked to a bunch of people at Columbia Records. They were not interested in putting out Raymond Scott music. I talked to my friends at Rhino. They weren't interested. I didn't have that many contacts at record labels, but everyone I went to, no one cared about Raymond Scott. Even if they liked the cassette, they were not interested in putting it out. There was no market for it. Then a whole bunch of things happened over the course of several years. Number one, a CD came out called The Carl Stalling Project. Warner Brothers put it out. It consisted of soundtracks by Carl Stalling done for Warner Brothers cartoons. And suddenly cartoon music became recognized as the product of a genius by the name of Carl Stalling. And there were a whole bunch of Raymond Scott musical quotes in there. And the liner notes alluded to Carl Stalling using the melodies of other composers and adapting them and arranging them and twisting them and turning them and stretching them and flipping them upside down and doing amazing things with them. But also probably 70% of those cartoons, the music is composed by Carl Stalling. He himself was an absolute genius. So there was a clue that Raymond Scott didn't work for Warner Brothers, that his music was used by Carl Stalling. Then a book came out called That's All, Folks. This book changed my life, and it explained how Raymond Scott's music ended up in Warner cartoons. The book was written by Steve Schneider. Well, I started talking to people like Steve Schneider and Hal Wilner, who was involved with the Carl Stalling Project, Greg Ford, who was an expert in Warner Brothers cartoons and knew about Raymond Scott's music, Will Friedwald, who did the first book about Warner cartoons. You have to realize that in the early 80s, these cartoons were not taken seriously. They weren't considered art. They weren't considered worthy of preservation. They were kid stuff. People like Jerry Beck, Will Friedwald, Nancy Beeman, Greg Ford, Leonard Maltin, they were part of what became known as the Warner Cartoon Mafia. They thought these cartoons were pure genius on every level. And they were right. And they set out to prove it. And they started doing screenings in New York at the Thalia, like midnight screenings of these cartoons. And they were becoming incredibly, incredibly popular. So that led to this recognition that cartoons are art and need to be taken seriously and respected and preserved. So this is all happening at the time that I'm on this Raymond Scott kick. That was the gateway drug that, oh, Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck cartoons had Raymond Scott music. I want to hear it. People would hear it and they'd love it. Actually, there was one other thing I left out, finding Raymond Scott. I still didn't know where Raymond Scott was, if he was dead or alive. I just couldn't find any information about him personally. And then one day I get a phone call from Byron Werner, who tells me he found Raymond Scott. I said, where'd you find him? He said, in the phone book. Maybe there were a couple of Raymond Scotts. He called them all, but he got the right one. Unfortunately, what he found out was Raymond was suffering, had suffered several strokes and couldn't speak. So his wife, Mitzi, took the call, spoke to Byron. This would have been in 1990 and said, Raymond's alive, but he's not well. He's had strokes. He's partly paralyzed. He can't have a conversation. He can't work. And we have no money and no one cares about his music. It's all out of print. We get very few royalties and no one wants to help us. They just didn't know people in the record business, in the music business. Raymond was history. So Byron gave me Mitzi's number, Mitzi Scott. I called her and spoke to her, and it was a pretty tragic situation that she described. And I offered to help. Now, again, I'm approaching 40. I have no professional grounding. I have no background of accomplishment. I don't have a profession. I don't have identifiable skills in terms of management and project development and publishing and licensing or any of that stuff. I just said, I want to do this. So Mitzi Scott said, well, nobody else wants to do it. So sure, Irwin, let's do a contract. We did a contract. So I became the representative of Raymond Scott's music. And from that point on began this incredible learning experience. I'm a three-time college dropout. I never finished my second year. And I've never, ever regretted that. I just was not interested in a collective education. I needed to learn from people one-on-one. I realized that if I'm going to learn anything, I want to learn it from people who know more than me. So suddenly I had a reason at the age of 40 to learn a lot about the music business. And I started going to people and asking them questions. I was pestering them with questions. I was grateful for any information they could impart to me. And there were so many people who were so helpful, who taught me so many things. And I took that information and ran with it and just decided that if ever I was going to have a career, I think this could be the basis of it. I think I can get Raymond Scott's music out there, and I have a stake in getting it out there because I'm going to be getting a commission if we can generate some money. Will Friedwald helped me. He was doing kind of A&R for a reissue label called Stash Records in the 80s. They were reissuing a lot of old public domain jazz things, doing a great job of it. It was around that time that I played recordings of Raymond Scott for Will Friedwald. And when we found out that Raymond had a lot of discs that he owned, they were private pressings. Will said he wanted to put out a CD. So we issued a CD in 1991 called The Raymond Scott Project Powerhouse Volume 1 on Stash. And it didn't sell a lot, but it attracted the attention of the right people. Suddenly, people were hearing Raymond Scott's music, and it sounded like classic cartoon music, but it wasn't made for cartoons. It was just Raymond Scott's music. It seemed perfectly suitable for cartoons, but Raymond was not into cartoons, as I learned later. He didn't even watch them. So I was contacted by Bob Camp. No, actually, I met a woman by the name of Linda Semensky, who was working at Nickelodeon. She was a friend of a friend, and she knew I was the guy who was working with these Raymond Scott recordings. And she says, we have a new cartoon series we're launching. It's called Ren and Stimpy.
Oh, wow.
And they want to use Raymond Scott music. Can you help them? And I said, sure, absolutely. So I talked to Bob Camp, John Crisfalusi, and they were just nuts about Raymond Scott based on that CD I'd produced for Stash. And I said, well, we can license this music for Ren and Stimpy. At some point, Hal Wilner, who had always been very helpful to me and receptive, but there wasn't much he could do for me, he had just signed a deal with Columbia Records through a guy named Steve Berkowitz to produce a bunch of records for Columbia, one of which became Weird Nightmare. It was a Charles Mingus multi-artists project. And he said he wanted to do a Raymond Scott record with Columbia, but he told Steve Berkowitz, yeah, let's do a Raymond Scott record, but let's get this guy Irwin in here because he seems to know more about it than we do. So they brought me on board. Hal very graciously pretty much stepped aside and let me make the record the way I wanted to make it. He had very little input, and he was fine with that. I think just the fact that he opened the door for me, I was grateful. He knew I could do it, and he trusted me to put together a great project, and I did. And Steve Berkowitz was happy with it. And I chose all the music for it. I wrote the liner notes. I got the photos. I titled it. I helped design the front cover. The project really, I was hands-on through the entire project. Now, this I'm telling you this because everything that I had done up to my life in my life up to the age of 40 suddenly came into play. I knew how to write. I knew how to research. I knew about graphic design. I knew about cartoons. I knew about music. I knew about jazz. I knew about old records. I knew how to be civil with people, how to negotiate deals. So everything came into play that I had, all my hobbies, all my passions, all my interests suddenly became the basis of my first really big professional success, that record. Reckless Nights and Turkish Twilights. Well, Columbia then said, oh, Ren and Stimpy's interested in using Raymond Scott music? Well, don't use those old recordings that were on Stash. Use ours. So Columbia stepped in, licensed their recordings for Ren and Stimpy. Thanks to Ren and Stimpy, the record didn't sell a lot, but it put Raymond Scott on the map and it put me on the map. Oh, Irwin Chusett, he's that Raymond Scott guy. Wow, that's really interesting. And Raymond Scott started generating a little bit of money for me and for Mitzi and Raymond. And I figured, good, I did that. At least if I die tomorrow, I accomplished one thing. Everything else before that seems very minor compared to putting that CD together.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
I remember in the early to mid 90s, there were a series of compilation CDs that came out. I'm trying to think of the labels they were on. It might have been Rhino.
History of Space Age Pop.
Yes.
Was on BMG, and Rhino did a whole series. Capital did a whole series. This music exploded. Absolutely. Yeah, you're right.
Could we say, draw a line right to Raymond Scott, and your work on that sort of opened the floodgates to this, did it not?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that, first of all, it originated with Byron Werner championing this music, but Byron was not in the music business. Byron wasn't producing records or compilations. He was just making cassette tapes and sending them out to friends. This sort of picks up the story, and I'll leave off of Raymond Scott. So then I thought, what do I do next? Well, Esquivel. Loved Esquivel's music. I knew it was out of print. I had all the vinyl, and it was all scratchy. And I thought, gee, wouldn't it be great to hear Esquivel's recordings on a compact disc, which was the format du jour, because it'll sound crystal clear. And I thought, the only way to do that is to go to the people who own the recordings and ask and say, hey, I'm the Raymond Scott guy. I want to do an Esquivel compilation. And I went to BMG. There was a very nice guy named Paul Williams. Not that Paul Williams. Not that Paul Williams. And not that Paul Williams. It was yet another Paul Williams. Very nice guy. And I remember sitting across from him, and he said, I think this stuff is interesting, but we're never going to put it out because there's no market for it. And I don't think that many people are interested in it. But if you can find an independent label that wants to put out Esquivel, we'll license it to them. So then, of course, I went back to Rhino, and they weren't interested. And then one day I was sitting outside at on the sidewalk at a table outside a restaurant in Hoboken, and Glenn Morrow of Bar None Records sees me sitting there and says, hey, Irwin, what are you working on? I said, well, I'm trying to get this Esquivel project off the ground, but no one seems to want to do it. And he said, who's Esquivel? And I gave him the rundown, and he says, why don't you stop by the office a few blocks away and bring a cassette and let us listen to it. I took a cassette of Esquivel over to the Bar None offices in 93. They heard it and they said, oh my God, we've got to do this. We've got to put this out. BMG had said, we'll license you the stuff, but you got to promise that you'll sell 5,000 CDs. And if you don't sell 5,000 CDs, you got to pay for 5,000 CDs because we're manufacturing. So Bar None said to me, can we sell 5,000 CDs of Esquivel? And I said, I don't know. I don't know 5,000 people. They decided to take the chance, and they did so much advanced publicity. And at that point, it really was, there was a, this type of music, this space age bachelor pad music, was becoming so popular on a collector's level that it had reached critical mass and the market was ready. And they sold 5,000 copies of the Esquivel CD before it was released, just in pre-orders. And they just continued repressing it, and it exploded. And in the wake of that, I did a second one for Bar None. I did one for BMG called Cabaret Mañana. And suddenly every label wanted to get in on the Space Age Bachelor Pad thing. I was already managing the Raymond Scott rights. Esquivel's music started getting a lot of attention and licensing opportunities. We discovered he was still alive. It was another, again, Byron coming through. We tracked down Esquivel. He was in Jutepec, Mexico, but he was an invalid. He had a back injury and was bedridden. I spoke to him on the phone a few times, and he said he wanted to share his money with me. And I felt a little awkward, and I said, well, I don't want to just take your money, but who's your manager? And he says, I don't have a manager. And I said, look, I'm managing the Raymond Scott catalog. Maybe I can manage your catalog. I'm coming to Mexico. We're going to meet. I'll spend a few days there. We'll talk. We'll work up a management agreement. And that's what happened. So I undertook administration of the Raymond Scott rights and the Esquivel rights. Meanwhile, I'm learning about music publishing. I'm learning about entertainment law. I'm learning about music distribution. I'm learning about record labels. I'm learning how to deal with music executives. I'm learning how to deal with musicians. I'm learning how to deal with music estates. Every aspect of these building blocks of my career were a challenge. But I had the skill set that I had developed while I was a hobbyist, while I was a non-professional, while I was broke, that continued to pay dividends in the sense that, oh, I've never done this before, but I think I can figure this out. And if I have any questions, there's a couple of people here I can rely on, lawyers, paralegals, music publishers who can help me and give me advice and guide me. And that's what happened. By the early 2000s, I'd had quite a track record of success with very unusual things that they were just out there, but nobody thought they could, there was a market for them. No one thought they could make money on them. No one thought they could sell this. No one thought they could license. No one thought they could use this. The Langley School's music project was rejected by 10 different labels, including, again, Rhino Records. They've turned down so many of my projects over the years. And at the time, they were good friends. I love them. At the time, Rhino was groundbreaking. And it was fun, a fun place. But someone at Rhino, when I played him the Langley School's music project, he said, Irwin, this is something that no one will ever listen to a second time. And I disagreed. Eventually, I got the Langley School's music project out. Sold incredibly. It was written about everywhere, and it went to number one on Amazon. It became a landmark project. It wasn't even a reissue. It was these are private pressings that I managed to track down and put together a contract with various parties, none of whom claimed they owned it. I couldn't use prevailing music biz protocols to put these projects together. I really had to be imaginative to do the honorable thing, do the right thing, and also to do it right creatively and retain control over, you know, the end product, as I've always done.
However poorly we Americans may nurture our children, at least in contrast to our often stated goals. Ours does remain predominantly a child-oriented society, for we see ourselves in our children, what we were, what we might yet become through them, and educating them remains a subject of great interest for us all.
You're attributed with the phrase outsider music. Now, this seemed to have come out in 1996, just sort of as, I'm finger quoting for those listening, alternative music was becoming firmly embedded in pop culture. When I hear the phrase outsider music, I can sense almost a phrase born out of frustration. Did it come from that? Well, like alternative
my frustration
music.
Or the artist's frustration?
Well, that's even better. I hear it as your frustration. It's like, well, that's not really alternative. This is alternative. You know, there's nothing really alternative about what Alice in Chains is doing. However, this is alternative. This is outsider.
It's a good question and a fair one, and one I've really never been asked. It's a different take on what is outsider music. Why is outsider music? Going back to the 70s, I was collecting odd music. I've always been drawn to something that I'd never heard before and something that other people didn't know about, something that I didn't know the backstory. What is this thing? I'd find these things and I recognized that there was a certain quality that I was finding in certain artists like Lucia Pamela, Shags, Wesley Willis, Jandek.
For those folks that are listening now and they don't know these names, were these artists associated with what we'll call major labels or even mini majors? Or
oh,
were
no.
they just,
no.
okay. Okay.
Closest thing to an outsider on a major label, there's a very obvious, I mean, it could be a lot, but in particular, Brian Wilson. I think Brian Wilson was absolutely an outsider.
Huh.
He just happened to sell hundreds, millions of records because he had an incredible pop gift, but the way he worked in the studio, the way he worked with musicians, the way he worked with the wrecking crew, the way he arranged things. I mean, go listen to Smiley Smile. It's an outsider record. I love Smiley Smile. When people talk about how great the Beach Boys are, they never talk about Smiley Smile. What's going on here? So there were just all these artists who were making records and putting them out themselves, and I'm collecting them and playing them on the radio. And I'm just thinking, the thing they had in common, it's not that they were bad. It's not that they were incompetent. It's not that they were awful. It was that they were sincere. They were making music that defied convention, but they weren't doing it to shock anyone. They weren't doing it to be different. They weren't doing it to annoy people. There was a sincerity. It was someone's artistic expression that seemed naive, that seemed well-meaning, well-intentioned, honest, but kind of disconnected from what most people consider good music. And I'm playing this stuff on the radio. I'm collecting it. I started writing about it. In 1996, Jackson Brian Griffith, who was the editor of Pulse magazine, knew what I was doing. He'd read some of these articles, and he knew about me and knew Raymond Scott. He knew about Esquivel. And he wrote to me and said, do you want to write an article for Pulse about the 10 weirdest albums in your collection? I said, sure. It was the only difficulty was figuring out which 10 because I had a lot of stuff. So I actually narrowed it down, not so much to 10 records, but 10 artists. When I started writing this article, I hit on this phrase, outsider music. Now, up until that point, outsider art had long been recognized. Art brut, folk art, whatever you want to call it, outsider art existed for decades, maybe for a century at that point. There have been exhibits of it. There were any number of icons in the field of outsider art. We're talking about visual art. There were outsider photographers, there were outsider filmmakers, outsider poets, outsider literature, outsider sculptors, outsider landscapers. But for some reason, the words outsider and music had not been conjoined.
Wow.
And suddenly it seemed, it was this great eureka moment that, oh, so all this stuff that I've been collecting over the years, all this weird stuff, it actually has a category. And I guess I'm going to kind of define it. So I used the phrase outsider music in that article in Pulse. The title of the article I did not write. That was written by Jackson Brian Griffith. And his title was, "So, you want alternative? ?" I thought it was a good title. So he was creating this alternative. I wasn't doing that, but I was coining the phrase outsider music. They worked. There was a symbiosis there between the title and my coining this phrase. And suddenly, you know, one more thing that Irwin did, he became the outsider music guy. I always refer to the Langley School's music project as a gateway drug to outsider music, because the Langley School's music project is definitely outsider. It's sincere and it's beautiful and it's haunting, but there's a lot of people who don't get it, who just think it's trash. Mm-hmm. Other people, it brings them to tears because there's such great beauty. It's the sound of children falling in love with music.
Yeah. I want to continue this conversation.
Absolutely.
I'm riveted, and I look at what you've done and the things that you've accomplished. It's like seeing hope.
Be sure to check out Irwin's radio show every Friday from noon to 3 on WFMU or WFMU.org. The songs you heard during this podcast were Dinner Music for a Pack of Hungry Cannibals and Powerhouse by Raymond Scott, Dancing in the Dark by Esquivel, and Space Oddity by the Langley School's Music Project. All of these songs and artists are available to stream wherever you stream your favorite music. Please be sure to check out the episode notes. We'll have links there for all the stuff that you're probably scratching your head about now. Be sure to register and join us for part 2 of our conversation with Irwin Chusid. Abandoned Albums was recorded at Thunder Love Studios.
Produced and written by Keith R. Higgins and Rob Janicki.
Engineered and mixed by Steve Beasley. Edited by A.J. Royce.
Original music by Mike Pellegrino. If you like what you've heard, be sure to subscribe and follow us on social media. At Twitter, we are at Abandoned Albums. And on Instagram, we are at Abandoned_Albums.
Many thanks to Ronnie Barnett, Bailey Leaf, Rob Janicki, S.W. Loudon, Michael Janicki, Steve Beasley, Mike Pellegrino, Therina Bella, Peyton Janicki, and of course, our executive producer,
Rufus Thunderlove.
And now, until we meet again next time, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
Abandoned Albums is a production of Paw Print Media.